You're listening to a resource from the Association of Certified Biblical Counselors, where we seek to promote excellence in biblical counseling. For more resources or to find out more information about ACBC, please visit us at biblicalcounseling.com.
God of heaven, we're thankful for the opportunity that we have to think through and understand the challenges of today. We're thank you for your word that equips us to face the challenges of things that we may be, at this point, totally unfamiliar with. We're thankful for your spirit that teaches us. Father, would you please help us in this time? And Lord, we'll just thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. I was listening to NPR one day. Don't stone me for that. And the host was interviewing Michael Pollan, the author of the book, How to Change Your Mind and What the Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. This is the book. And they were discussing how psychedelics were proving effective in liberating people who had a terminal diagnosis, how it was effective in liberating them from the fear of death, that they would administer the psychedelics, and with one dose, these folks came out not fearing death at all. He talked about people taking psychedelic drugs, embarking on these, what he called journeys, helped by a guide, which is someone trained to walk you through the journey while you're under that. And he claimed that psychiatrists were saying they had never seen anything so effective in helping people as these drugs. Now, I'm not an expert in this area. I have to tell you that. My interest was picked last year or when I heard that. I wrote a booklet last year about counseling the dying, and part of what I heard is in that booklet, and it forced me to think even more. So last year when they asked about topics, I said, well, shoot, I'll just tackle psychedelics. And it's been a real interesting trip. Believe me, I did not. It's not in my notes. It just happened, all right? But there, you know, we could really dive deep into this today. And there's just so much that I can't say. And so I'm just going to try to just kind of skim along the top. There's so much to say here. And I have to tell you, it was fascinating. This is a fascinating subject. I'm going to paint the history of their use in very broad strokes. And frankly, it's a fascinating story with a whole roster of unbelievably colorful characters. Now, the use of psychedelics to enhance creativity and innovation through microdosing has been popularized by the likes of Joe Rogan and Aaron Rodgers. And I can't tell you how disappointed I was to hear that about Aaron Rodgers, but nevertheless, the idea of microdosing is really, really popular. Now, what you can do is, it's not legal yet, but you microdose, you take a small dose on one day, and then you have 2 days, and then you take another dose. And it's supposed to help you in terms of creativity and innovation. It's now hailed as the answer to psychiatric problems. Now, research, if you're not familiar with it, research in the last few years, the macro studies they've done in the last few years, the psychiatric and medical establishment, has said that, no, we were wrong about chemical imbalance and antidepressants. The big news now is that that's being abandoned. The idea of chemical imbalance is now headed for the ash heap. Now, it's not come downstream yet, right? Our doctors back home are not there yet. Sadly, too many people in our church aren't there yet either. But because of that, they're turning to psychiatric drugs. They're turning away. And this is what caught my attention, is that they're turning away from the psychotropic drugs that have been used for the last couple decades, and now they're turning to psychiatric drugs. And someone says, well, then why are psychiatrists turning to another drug therapy if they're saying that the drugs weren't the answer? Well, here's the issue. It's not drug therapy. That's the issue in the sense of explaining a change in the biochemistry of the brain, like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, you know, and all that sort of thing. It's not about that. Instead, the object of these new studies is how a mystical spiritual experience that people have, and now that's the issue that they have, that the drugs produce. It's this incredible, transcendent, transforming, mystical, spiritual experience that people have. That's the issue, not the brain chemicals. Okay? That's what caught my attention early on, is this incredible idea that, yeah, we're not about the brain chemistry. We're all about this transcendent, spiritual, mystical experience that so transforms a person that he no longer fears death or struggles with addiction. Okay? That's the issue. The subjects of the study is not the drugs. The subjects of the study are the mystical spiritual experience. That's what's going on. And someone might object, but that's not science. And you're right. Some have called it shamanism in a white coat. It's not science. Some of these researchers are very uncomfortable with this. They're very uncomfortable with this. The line between mysticism and science is getting blurred in a major way. And so it's interesting to see how these practitioners are reacting to it. Well, someone might ask, what are the drugs? Well, there's ayahuasca, a psychedelic tea made from a combination of plants native to the Amazon basin. So that's a popular one. DMT, dimethyltryptamine. It's a rapid onset, intense, and short-acting psychedelic compound, sometimes referred to as the businessman's trip. The tryptamine molecules found in many plants and animals and evidently found in as well in our brains. Of course, there's the good old favorite LSD, lysergic acid, diethylamide. You know, I practiced all these. I mean, I knew LSD. I'm a child of the 60s, okay? So I know LSD, acid, the whole thing. I can remember Timothy Leary, all that stuff. I grew up in that era. But anyway, LSD is a psychedelic compound that was synthesized by Albert Hofmann, a Swiss chemist, back in the 40s. And he was searching for a drug to stimulate circulation. It didn't seem to work. 5 years later, he came back, and he was working on the 25th molecule of this compound that he had derived from alkaloids produced by ergo, a fungus that infects grapes. And he accidentally ingested some of it and had an unbelievable trip that just, again, changed his whole perspective on life, right? And you hear his testimony. Listen, you hear the testimony of these people and what they've seen, and you go, wow, that is incredible, right? That is, and I'm telling you right now, this is going to be an extraordinarily tempting thing, because what they're talking about is an experience that is unbelievable. You know, seeing the world in a different way that you've never seen it before. In 1947, the company he was working for, Sandoz, began marketing LSD as a psychiatric drug under the name Delicid. And then there's MDMA, okay? Methylene dioxymethamphetamine, first synthesized by the Merck Company in 1912. It was resynthesized in the Bay Area by a chemist by the name of Alexander Shulgin in the 1970s. Now, it became popular to use in psychotherapy. You know what psychotherapy is? It's that talk therapy based on Freudian ideas, okay? When I use the term psychotherapy, that's what you need to be thinking. It's talk therapy that came from Freud and his disciples. Anyway, it became popular to use in psychotherapy because it possessed an empathogenic quality, empathogenic, empathy, All right. It had the ability to help patients form a strong bond of trust with their therapists. All right. We know it today as ecstasy. Okay. Then there's mescaline, a psychedelic compound derived from several cacti, including peyote and San Pedro, and used by Native Americans in their worship. You know, I'm sorry, I'm not keeping up here. And then there's the biggie, the popular one, the easy one, psilocybin. The main psychoactive compound found in psilocybin mushrooms, and that's what's in them, and it's a shorthand for the class of mushrooms that contain it. Magic mushrooms is what they're called. This is probably the most popular. All right? Now, I want to talk about the history of psychedelics because, I don't know. I think you got to understand the history of something. And this is a fascinating history, all right? I found out this is not such a new frontier. I thought, wow, this is really a big thing. This is something new. It's not new at all. I thought it was, but I found that psychedelics had been the subject of serious psychiatric research in the 50s and up through the mid 60s. There was a ton of research going on the psychedelics, tons of it, all right? And it's like all been buried because of the fact that like LSD became a Schedule I drug. And so all those decades of study were lost for quite a while. So let's talk about that for a moment. What about the day? I've organized these around the days of discovery. Now, of course, the use of psychedelics goes all the way back to the myths of prehistory, where they were used for religious worship. Shamans would administer the drugs and then guide the religious experience. Okay? In fact, there are some who would assert that these drug-induced mystical experience actually provide the very root of all religion. All religion started here, is what they would assert, okay? They would assert that even the religion we're a part of, right? It all started way back there with mystical experiences. And so it's nothing new in that regard. It's been around for a long time. For example, the use of mushrooms in Central America and Mexico in Native American worship. They produce visions, and the mushroom would carry you where God is, all right? Would carry you where God is. But when the conquistadors came along and conquered them, through the priests, they forbade them to have any more, to use any of those plants for divination because it was an act of superstition and would destroy the purity and the integrity of the Catholic faith. And so their use didn't end. Their use did not end. It just went underground. And you know, you could go down and find some of these shaman-like people who would do this, right? It's still very much a part of what's going on. Now, in 1952, a vice president of J.P. Morgan by the name of J.R. Wasson heard about psychoactive mushrooms used by Mesoamerican Native Americans from the middle part of America. And so he decided to explore this. Okay, and so in 52, he did that. He made 10 trips to that part of the continent. And in 1955, he had his first experience with the sacred mushroom, launching him into amazing visions. He found, you know, he asked around, he found this one woman who was the one who administered him. And so he went and had his first drug experience in 1955. In 1957, he published an article called Seeking the Magic Mushroom in Life magazine. Now, many of you aren't old enough to remember those things. I am. Maybe you've heard of the Time Life publishing empire. This was Henry Luce and Claire Booth Luce who founded that publishing empire. All right? And Life was kind of like this big picture magazine, kind of. It had some, you know, articles and stuff, but it was a big picture magazine. It was bigger than most. And it was like a family magazine, okay? It was like a family magazine. And the Luces were probably the most conservative, anti-communist people on the planet, all right? They were, you want to talk about establishment people, they were it, all right? And so the news of the magic mushroom's amazing qualities found its way into mainstream America. So what you have to imagine now is you sitting down in the middle of the 50s, mid-50s, and reading this article about magic mushrooms. Wow, that's interesting. Wow, I didn't know things could do that, right? What's the point? It doesn't have any stigma. It's a part of, well, this is interesting, okay? Now, you know, the Luce family, the Luces were familiar with psychedelics, okay? Again, this incredibly conservative couple, they shared the enthusiasm of the medical and cultural elites who embraced them in the 50s. They were using these. They were taking trips. That was part of what they do. And Henry, in fact, told his staff that he and Claire had been taking LSD under the doctor's supervision. Okay? Again, I want you to get in your mind, this is a very conservative couple, right? And they're using LSD. That rattles our brains, doesn't it? That's like, what? No. That kind of history you got there. But that's true. Time Life Publications were enthusiastic boosters of psychedelics, all right? Now, even before them, through the writings of Aldous Huxley and the late 19th century Harvard philosopher, philosopher promoted a philosophical system called pragmatism, William James, who also was the first we might call psychologist because he was examining things like his most famous book is on religious experience. He's trying to study human nature. Both of these guys were extolling the virtues of this mescaline altered consciousness. They both were extolling this. I mean, back in the late 19th century, you got William James talking about this kind of altered consciousness. All right? Aldous Huxley, you all know Aldous Huxley, right? We all had to read his books in high school literature. This guy was a major, major proponent, advocate for, user of psychedelics, okay? Now, you need to understand what this means. This is why I've labored this point. Psychedelic drugs had not yet acquired any of the cultural and political stigmas that now colors our attitudes today, right? You know, even as I tell folks, yeah, what are you doing? I'm doing something on psychedelics. And, you know, there's some kind of joke because it's very stigmatized, or it has been stigmatized for a whole generation. But what you need to understand is that it wasn't at the beginning. It was just something that we're going to do research on. It's something we can experience. It's something every, you know, we can do this. So it didn't carry the stigma that it does today. Now, because of such widespread acceptance, the psychedelic soon became the subject of scientific inquiry, okay? There we go. And so now we start getting into the research. We call this the first wave of research, all right? So there are a number of places and organizations that grew up. So let me just name a few of them. Spring Grove State Hospital, right outside of Baltimore. in the early 50s started working with us. They actively conducted an ambitious program of psychedelic research with schizophrenics, alcoholics and other addicts, cancer patients struggling with the distress of approaching death, and people with severe, what they would call severe personality disorders. All right? In fact, in 1965, CBS did an hour-long special report. I remember this as a kid. There were three major networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. CBS was the big news one because they had Walter Cronkite, who was the dean of all television journalists, okay? And CBS News used to do these special reports. I remember as a kid. You know, you didn't have to go to Netflix to watch documentaries. You could watch them every week on the three major networks. Well, CBS did an hour-long sympathetic special report on this hospital's, on Spring Grove's work with alcoholics called LSD, the Spring Grove Experiment. It was instrumental in leading Maryland, the Maryland legislature, to establish a multi-million dollar research facility on that campus. Okay? Then there's, I got to tell you, I want y'all ought to read this book. It's history. Yeah, it's an apologetic for using psychedelics. It is that. But man, you want to read history. He's really done a great job. And there are so many people, I can't remember all their names. And as I read through the book, I'm trying to make all the connections. But a couple of them were Humphrey Osmond and Abram Hoffer. Now, Humphreys came from Great Britain. He was working at a hospital there in London. They weren't crazy about any of the psychedelic stuff, but Saskatchewan Mental Hospital in Weyburn said, well, come on. And so he went there, and there was, they were just starting their national, or in the province, they were just starting the medical system that became the national system. Got money for you, so he came. And Saskatchewan Mental Hospital in Weyburn became the world's most important hub of research into psychedelics. And here's the first time that they began to turn away from seeing LSD as a window into the biochemistry of mental illness and had an increasing curiosity about the power of the experience itself. That then, they were amazed. They were trying to figure out the biochemistry, but the power of the experience in changing these people's lives became what became the center of their attention, because they started to see that this drug-induced change of perception might itself confer some therapeutic benefits. All right, Harvard University. One of their professors had started thinking about it. They, in the 1960s, when Leary came to head up the psilocybin project there at Harvard. The International Foundation for Advanced Study formed in 1961. It was almost like a counseling center. And in 6 years, they said they had processed, as they put it, 350 people. Now, there were many other institutions, but that gives you an idea that psychedelics were not those scary drugs used on the streets, but rather serious subjects of research. Now, we have to understand about the evolution of psychedelic understanding, okay? And see, how did they see the drug? Well, the first way they saw it, they called it the psychotomimetic. Now, do you see anything in there that might catch your attention?
Mimic.
All right. This was the first model that they had, this psychotomimetic model. It was coined in 1950. And when researchers administered LSD, what they saw seemed to mimic the symptoms of schizophrenia. So that's what they saw. When people were on their trip, on their journey, this is what they saw. And so they said, aha, this may give us insight into how chemicals produce schizophrenia or some of these other problems, okay? That was the first model, okay? It suggested that the basis of a mental disorder was indeed chemical, okay? So it's interesting, they see these people on these trips and think, God, that's like schizophrenia. There must be something going on. This must have induced it. And so there's maybe some kind of chemical that's involved in that. But it didn't bring on full-blown psychosis. And in fact, they found these people, it seemed pleasurable and transforming, as a matter of fact. And so, that started to fade. And then came the psycholytic model of understanding. Psycholytic, mind loosening. This is a term coined in the 60s, where LSD is being interpreted as something that loosened the constraints of the mind, allowing the subconscious material to enter into your awareness. So in other words, now it's not mimicking a mental disorder. Instead, what we're seeing that is that it can help us in our psychotherapy. It's an adjunct to psychotherapy. It's going to loosen up your mind so that you recall those things that you've repressed, right? You know how that works, right? We got all this stuff underneath here that we're holding down, we're repressing, but it's that which motivates us to do, according to Freud. And so this is starting to loosen everything up so that we can do psychotherapy more effectively, okay? And then, finally, you get the psychedelic therapy model. Now, that's combining two words that together mean mind manifesting. So from mind loosening to mind manifesting. It does not suggest madness or insanity, but an enlargement or an expansion of the mind. Instead of helping some sort of therapy, it became the therapy. You see? Instead of being an adjunct to a therapy, it now then became the therapy. And psychedelic therapy had come into its own by the mid-50s. And what it was, it consisted of a single high-dose session, usually LSD, that took place in comfortable surroundings with the subject on a couch with a therapist or two in attendance, saying little but allowing the journey to unfold according to its own logic. And so what you see here is that rather than being an object of fear and outrage, by the mid-1960s, psychedelics was considered a serious field of study and research. Because think about this. Beginning in the 50s, they were used to treat a whole host of conditions, including addiction, depression, OCD, schizophrenia, autism, and end-of-life anxiety. It was being used for those things in the 50s. There had been 40,000 participants, this up to when it was outlawed. The Americans, more than 1,000 clinical papers had been published on this research, okay? The American Psychiatric Association had whole meetings centered around LSD, whole meetings centered around that, called the New Wonder Drug. There were 6 international scientific meetings devoted to psychedelics between 1950 and 1965. What's the point? The point is that it wasn't always this hippie, underground, crazy thing. It was the subject of research, which is happening now. But between then and the second wave comes the underground, days in the underground. Now, this is the era that we're all most familiar with because we've all grown up in the underground era. We've all grown up in it. What happened? Okay. Everything went south because of the antics and the antics that I have that in quotes. That's what most of these researchers from the 50s and 60s called what Leary did. Antics. He was a professor at Harvard. He was a professor of psychology. He'd launched the Harvard Psilocybin Project in 1960. By 1963, he was dismissed from Harvard's faculty. One reason was that he refused to follow the protocols for experiments. You know, all the double-blind placebo control. Yeah, all of that. He refused to do that. In fact, for him, you got to do it too. You got to do it too. You won't even begin to understand your people until you do it. All right? And he became a promoter of LSD as a means of personal and cultural transformation. Right? What was his famous saying? He was saying to America's youth, some of you are too young. You never heard this, but I remember it. Turn on, tune in, and drop out. Right? So it wasn't so much what it was he seemed to be one of these guys who was leading the revolution. Now, if you lived in the 60s, all right, if you lived in the 60s, let me tell you, it was like it is today. There's been intervening decades. But in the 60s, to a kid in eighth grade in 1968, it looked like everything was falling apart. I mean, there was just riots and cities burning and RFK and Martin Luther King assassinated, and it was just crazy. Vietnam, right? And so you have this guy promoting this kind of anti-establishment rebellion, and part of that is turning on and tuning in and dropping out, right? Michael Pollan writes this, dated and goofy as those words sound to our ears, there was a moment when they were treated as a credible threat to the social order, an invitation to America's children not only to take mind-altering drugs, but to reject the path laid out for them by their parents and their government, including the path taking young men to Vietnam. And so it seems like the perfect storm of social unrest and a non-conforming professor threw the U.S. into the throes of as Pollan would say, a moral panic about LSD. Because now it was no longer, we need to research this. It was, everybody, let's go, right? And so a lot of these former researchers hated Leary. Now, let me just say something right now. You may think that I'm an apologist here for LSD and psilocybin. I am not. But I do want you to get a hold of the fact that this isn't just a bunch of loonies trying to get their hands on LSD. We're talking about people who are serious about research, okay? They're serious about doing this research. And we're going to have answers for that, right? And so I want to really get... Wow, we got to move, okay? So, here's my plan. My plan is not for me to stand up here and give you all the critiques, although I have them down. I'm going to ask you to start thinking through these things, and you start proposing how you're going to answer people when this becomes the mainstream, okay? So get ready.
It already is.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, it is pretty mainstream. All right. So psychedelics become a Schedule I drug. That is, it's outlawed for any use at all, not even for research. It's done. That's why they're angry with him. And so all those years of research were buried for the next several decades and destroyed any possibility of future research. But the use of psychedelics continued underground, although illegally. I'm not just talking about street use. I'm not talking here about using it illegally, like, after the football game, let's get together and trip, right? That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who are seeking to help others through the use of psychedelics. That continued. That, for a lot of people, that became a mission for them, okay? And much of what researchers do today developed during this period, such as, okay, when you hear LSD, you're thinking just sitting somewhere with your friends and having a trip. But these people are talking about you have to have a guide during your psychedelic journey. You must have a guide. That was established. And those guides have to operate according to strict protocols, confidentiality, no sexual contact, certain ceremonial touches that go with the experiment, the experience like always taking the pill or the mushrooms from a cup. It has this sacramental idea, this religious idea. You've got to take it from a cup. The person taking the drug brings an object of personal significance. So Leon Zeff, who is one of these guides during the underground days, his first experience was the guide told him, bring something of personal significance to you. So he brought his Torah, right? The Old Testament, the law, that's the Jewish Bible. And after the effects of LSD had come on, his guide laid the Torah across my chest, and I immediately went into the lap of God. He and I were one. Okay? So you bring something of personal significance. If you're ever going to go on a journey, you got to bring something. Guides have to have personal experience of any medicine or psychedelic that he administers. You have to have experience with it. Guides should not try to direct or manipulate the psychedelic journey, allowing it to find its own course or destination. People on the trip, on the journey, are very susceptible to suggestion. You cannot manipulate it. You have to give flight instructions to the clients before they go on their journey, such as how to know what to do when unpleasant visions occur. Now, we don't have time to go into all this, but you start seeing music and hearing colors, okay? And there's going to be some really horrible things that may come up. This is typically what people would call a bad trip. And what they would say is, you would see death. I mean, you would see death coming at you. And the instruction of the guide would be, don't run away. Don't run away. Accept the fear that you see. Embrace it and ask, why are you here? What can I learn? So they would be there so that they give the flight instructions before they send you off on your journey. And then the day after the journey, the guide meets with you and you have to integrate all that you saw and heard, to try to see what you learned from it. Okay? And so most of these journeys are a three-day affair. There's the consultation with your guide first. You spend a day getting to know him, establishing involvement, if you will, getting to know that person. And then the second day is the administration of the drug and the journey under the supervision of your guide. And then the third day is set aside to integrate what happened on your journey. Now, the deal is psychedelic researchers today have used these guides to help them in their research. They've drawn on these underground folks after all these years to help them in their programs, okay? Like, they're using them, train the cohorts of the guides that we're going to use, you know, at Johns Hopkins. The Johns Hopkins team wanted to study the role of music in a guided psilocybin session. So who did they draw on? All these folks from the underground, all these people that have been operating under the radar for all these years. Can I tell you something? Reading through these stories, it's amazing how it mimics the gospel. It's unbelievable. Clients talk about conversion. So here's Fritz. The goal was to create the conditions for a spiritual epiphany, what amounted to a conversion experience. They're going to talk about how the experience was so profound, their life was completely changed. They've been transformed. Guides will talk about the compelling mission they have to bring this treatment to people. And during the underground days, many of these were psychiatrists who knew that they would lose their license if they were caught doing this, but they were willing to pay the cost. All right? Downright evangelistic in their enthusiasm. Okay, so It's fascinating to see that, especially this idea of conversion and transformation is big. It is big in the experience of these folks. Well, what about that second wave, the days of Renaissance? Real quickly, it began around 2006 with the U.S. Supreme Court's unanimous decision ruling in favor of UDV, a tiny religious sect from Brazil, who used dimethyltryptamine, was their sacrament. And on the basis of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993, they said they have the religious freedom to do that. So that opened the gates. This was also that was also the year that Roland Griffiths published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology. How's this for a title for a scientific paper, right? Psychopharmacology or psilocybin can occasion mystical type experiences having substantial and sustained personal meaning and spiritual significance, right? Now that got a torrent of coverage from the press. And so the former deputy, so men like the former deputy to George H.W. Bush, drug czar, Herbert Kleber, and Charles Schuster, who had served two Republican presidents as the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse. You know, this paper is great. This is great. Listen, this does not fall along political conservative liberal lines. You know who's just come out as a major proponent for psychedelics? Rick Perry. Remember Rick? The ultra-conservative governor of Texas who served as a cabinet officer under Trump? Now, why would he do that? Because he thinks this is the answer to PTSD. This is going to be effective for PTSD. And you have all these medical and professional organizations saying, we got to do this. We got to do this research. Now, there are two main centers of study that I can determine. There may be more, but this is what I found. New York University and Johns Hopkins University. These are the two that I can, in the reading I've done, these are the two that are the major centers of study right now, okay? What you've got to see is it's not a bunch of lunatics trying to have a good time. These are serious researchers, and we have to be ready for that. All right, what's their use? I'm going to talk about the driving philosophy behind it. Okay, now, I'm going to ask you to indulge me. I want to take you on one of those journeys. This is Patrick. He was a 53-year-old television news director. He had been treated for cancer of his bile ducts. He'd been diagnosed with cancer in 2007. By 2010, it had spread to his lungs. He was really struggling under the weight of going through chemotherapy and and his death, okay? And so here he signed up for the trials at NYU. Okay, he signed up for the trials at NYU. They were the trials that were using psychedelics, in this case, I believe it was psilocybin, to help people with the distress that they faced when dying. These are all people of terminal diagnoses. Okay, all right, I'm just going to highlight his trip here. Bear with me. I hope you find this interesting. Patrick, okay, has turned up. He's come up. Patrick would lie on the couch wearing eye shades and listening through headphones to a playlist of carefully curated music. This is how you start. Eye shades, all eye shades, and listening to music. Two sitters, or who would be his guides, one of them male, Dr. Bossis, who's doing the research, and the other a female, Cristalia Calianzi, would be in attendance for the duration, saying very little, but available to help should he run into any trouble. In preparation, the two shared with Patrick the set of flight instructions written by the Hopkins researcher, Bill Richards. Bossa suggested that Patrick use the phrase, trust and let go, as a kind of mantra for his journey. Go wherever it takes you, he advised. Climb staircases, open doors, explore paths, fly over landscapes. But the most important advice for the journey he offered is always to move forward rather than to try to flee. Anything truly threatening or monstrous you encounter, look it straight in the eyes, dig in your heels and ask, what are you doing in my mind, or what can I learn from you? Okay. Patrick was asked, before he took his journey, Patrick was asked to state his intention, which he said was to learn to cope better with the anxiety and depression he felt about his cancer and to work on what he called his regret in life. He placed a few photographs, personal items, around the room of himself and Lisa on their wedding day and of their dog, Arlo. At 9:30, Patrick lay down on the couch, put on the headphones and eye shades, and fell quiet. In his account, Patrick likened the start of the journey to the launch of a space shuttle, a physically violent and rather clunky liftoff, which eventually gave way to the blissful serenity of weightlessness. Early in his journey, Patrick encountered his brother's wife, who died of cancer more than 20 years earlier at 43. Ruth acted as my tour guide, he wrote, and didn't seem surprised to see me. She wore her translucent body so I could know her. This period of my journey seemed to be about the feminine. Michelle Obama made an appearance. The considerable feminine energy all around me made clear that the idea that a mother, any mother, regardless of her shortcomings, could never not love her offspring. This was very powerful. I knew I was crying. It was here that I felt as if I was coming out of the womb, being birthed again. My rebirth was smooth, comforting. Now, what he goes on to say is, to the observers, it didn't look like that. And when they listened to him, he gave birth, right? He gave birth in this journey. Now, Patrick asked to take a break. He removed the headphones and eye shades. I sat up and spoke with Tony and Crystalia. I mentioned that everyone deserved to have this experience, that if everyone did, no one could ever do harm to another again. Wars would be impossible to wage. The room and everything in it was beautiful. Tony and Crystalia sitting on their pillows were radiant. They helped them to the bathroom. Even the germs, if there were any present, were beautiful, as was everything in our world and universe. He got back, put on his eye shades and headphones, and laid back down. From here on, love was the only consideration. It was and is the only purpose. Love seemed to emanate from a single point of light, and it vibrated. I could feel my physical body trying to vibrate in unity with the cosmos. And frustratingly, I felt like a guy who couldn't dance. But the universe accepted it. The sheer joy, the bliss, the nirvana was indescribable. And in fact, there are no words to accurately capture my experience, my state, this place. I know I've had no earthly pleasure that's ever come close to this feeling. No sensation, no image of beauty. Nothing during my time on Earth has felt as pure and joyful and glorious as the height of this journey. The music loomed large in the experience. I was learning a song, and the song was simple. It was one note, C. It was the vibration of the universe, a collection of everything that ever existed, all together equaling God. I was convinced at that moment I had figured it all out. It was right there in front of me. Love, the only thing that mattered, that was now to be my life's cause. I took a tour of my lungs. I remember breathing deeply to help facilitate the seeing. Bossis noted that at 2:30, Patrick had said, I went into my lungs and saw two spots. They were no big deal. I was being told, without words, not to worry about the cancer. It's minor in the scheme of things, simply an imperfection of your humanity, and that the more important matter, the real work to be done, is before you. Again, love. Now Patrick experienced what he called a brief death. I approached what appeared to be a very sharp-pointed piece of stainless steel. It has a razor blade quality to it. I continued up to the apex of this shiny metal object, and as I arrived, I had a choice, to look or not look, over the edge and into the infinite abyss, the vastness of the universe, the eye of everything and of nothing. I was hesitant, but not frightened. I wanted to go all in, but felt that if I did, I would possibly leave my body permanently, death from this life. But it was not a difficult decision. I knew there was much more for me here. Telling his guides about the choice, Patrick explained that he was not ready to jump off and leave Lisa. Then rather suddenly, around 3 o'clock p.m., it was over. The transition from a state where I had no sense of time or space to the relative dullness of now happened quickly. I had a headache. When Lisa arrived to take him home, Patrick looked like he'd run a race, she recalled. The color in his face was not good. He looked tired and sweaty, but he was on fire. He was lit up with all the things he wanted to tell me and all the things he couldn't. He told her he had touched the face of God. All right? Now, again, bear with me just a little bit longer. He died 17 months later. After his session. But what's interesting is the last days of his life. Patrick's psychedelic journey had shifted his perspective from a narrow lens trained on the prospect of dying to a renewed focus on how best to live the time left to him. He had a new resolve that there was a point to his life, that he got it and was moving with it. He had a sense of, this is what Lisa says, he had a sense of patience he had never had before. And with me, he had real joy about things. It was as if he had been relieved of the duty of caring about the details of life and he could let it all that go. Now it was about being with people, enjoying his sandwich and the walk on the promenade. It was as if we lived a lifetime in a year. That fall, his lungs began to fail and Patrick wound up in the hospital. He gathered everyone together and said goodbye and explained that this is how he wanted to die. He had a very conscious death. Patrick's seeming equanimity in the face of death exerted a powerful influence on those around him, Lisa said, and his room in the palliative care unit at Mount Sinai became a center of gravity in the hospital. Everyone, the nurses and the doctors, wanted to hang out in our room. They just didn't want to leave. Patrick would talk and talk. It was like he was a yogi. He put out so much love. When Tony Bossis visited Patrick a week before he died, he was struck by the mood in the room and by Patrick's serenity. He was consoling me. He said his biggest sadness was leaving his wife, but he was not afraid. Lisa emailed me a photograph of Patrick she had taken a few days before he died. And when the image popped up open on my screen, it momentarily took my breath away. Here was an emaciated man in a hospital gown, an oxygen clip in his nose, but with bright, shining blue eyes and a broad smile. On the eve of death, the man was beaming. What about that bothers you? Does that make you feel uncomfortable? Why? Why does that make you feel uncomfortable?
Satan's attempt to replace God.
All right. It's Satan's attempt to replace God, but what's going on at the end of his life? Yes.
He comes to truth, right? He happens upon truth, but the means wasn't correct.
Well, what truth did he come upon?
Well, that love is a focus of life.
That's true.
But the why part of
okay.
Because there is no glorification of God.
No, there is not, is there? You know what bothers me about it? This guy is going out like every Christian should go out. Why is he doing that and we're not?
Yes, because the church has failed.
All right? Yeah.
I'm a hospice nurse. I got the occasion to attend Christians' deaths.
Yeah. That's good. I'm really glad to hear that.
And the staff remarks, what's going on here?
Yeah. But look, don't try to squirm around it. This guy went out great. And he didn't have a clue about Jesus, did he? That should tell you about changing people. What's the change? Now, let's do it. Let's start taking it apart. Oh, come on. Oh.
What's a counterfeit?
Yeah. It is a counterfeit, but guys.
But it's also a forbidden spiritual practice.
It's a forbidden. Here's what I want you to do. Don't just say, like, the Bible says we can't use in Book of the Revelation, those people who use drugs are going to hell. Let's not do that. Let's come with a system here. Did you hear Dale last night? One of the things he said is very clear, and that is people look at the symptoms as the problem.
Yeah.
Now, so these people are struggling with death approaching. What's the problem by the world? What's the problem?
Death.
No?
Fear.
It's the fear.
It's the fear of death.
So we center on the fear, don't we? And so the solution that's proposed deals with the fear, but not with the reality of death. Okay? You're right. Especially end of life care, this makes me tremble because I want people afraid of dying if they don't know Jesus. I want them to be terrified because what they're going to face is terrifying, right? But then they're delivered from that. Okay? Think about when you encounter these things. Oh, man. When you encounter these things, give me 5 extra minutes. You can leave if you want. All right, now look. Think about what Ernie said today. These are the questions you need to ask, because your unbelieving friend or even your Christian friends are going to come to you and they're going to say, why are you opposed to this? Look at all the good things that are happening. All right? So you always got to ask these questions. What's the source of authority? What is the source of the problem? What is the answer to the problem? How do people change? What's the methodology you use? And that grows out of the answers you have to the first three questions. Who leads or promotes the model? What is the role of the counselor? How does the system defend itself? Or what's the authority? What's the authority here?
Experience.
What is it?
Experience.
Yeah. This feeds right into our cultural Carl Truman, right? The elevation of the self. I experienced this. Who are you to say it's wrong? I was there. You know, he even talks about Dinah, an atheist, who says, I was overwhelmed with the love of God. Is she still an atheist? Yes. But she doesn't have words that can express it all, so she uses the word God. All right? And we didn't have time to get into what these all have in common. All right, so source of authority, personal, yes?
Well, I was just going to say, earlier you talked about how the trips mimic the gospel, you know, the conversion, and it's just, I mean, everything you're saying, Satan comes as an angel of light, right?
Yeah. Yep. Chapter 11 in 1 Corinthians epistles. Yeah. What's the source of the problem? Think about that. What's the source of the problem for the psychedelic researchers? People doing the research, what do they see as the problem? They're the counselors. What do they see as the problem?
Like person's discomfort. The person's symptoms.
How they feel.
How they feel, all right? But how do you solve that problem? Here's what they're saying. The problem is one of enlightenment, right? Which is another thing, and I didn't have time to get into it. Ask the question. Ask one of them, one of the researchers, in a 2014 interview in Science Magazine. They asked him, "Well, what if it's this transcendent reality that these people are experiencing? What if it's not true?" You know what his response was? Who cares whether it's true or not? It's producing great effects.
And we're bowing at the altar of pragmatism. Just like EMDR and the rest of
them. Yeah, we are. But I want you to remember, you got to keep this in mind for your counseling. You got to make sure your counseling is not about just relieving the pain. What is your goal? All right. It's to glorify Christ. That's the bottom line. I want to ask questions too, because I got to let you go. I ask questions like this: transformation. What do you mean by that? And notice it's all very me. I'm transformed. I don't worry. I don't have addictions, all these other things. It's about me. It's not about God. Okay? Now, look, this is coming down the pike. I wish we had another 20 minutes, but we'll leave it go at that. You've got to be asking these questions. Okay? And again, don't hear what I'm not saying. You need to know your Bible, but you need to be able to construct, as Ernie told us today, construct a system, all right, a worldview. We got a clash of worldviews here, but sometimes we don't see that and we just miss where the real problems are. So you've got to develop a biblical worldview when you're going to talk about these kinds of issues.
You're listening to a resource from the Association of Certified Biblical Counselors, where we seek to promote excellence in biblical counseling. For more resources or to find out more information about ACBC, please visit us at biblicalcounseling.com.